Okay, first of all, I would like to thank the organizer for organizing such an interesting summer school and workshop, and it's my pleasure to be here and talk. Well, what I'm going to talk about is basically it's written viscoelastic modeling of hydrocephalus, but basically I would talk about the biomechanics of the brain and quasi-viscoelasticity theory for the brain. But let's have some idea that why it's related to the hydrocephalus. There were quite beautiful talks yesterday, so I'm not going to go too much details on this hydrocephalus. Just to remind you that when the hydrocephalus is excessive accumulation of CSF within the brain cavities, and basically when the fluid is blocked by, you know, whatever, then it happens. And there are different kind of hydrocephalus that we learned yesterday. So what happens, basically, you can see, for example, what is the difference between a normal brain and the after, for example, getting hydrocephalus. So, and what actually, as we see yesterday, what is the best treatment for the hydrocephalus is using the shunt. But unfortunately, the rate of shunt failures is high in most reported series, and basically, we can say that the most common factor causing the shunt failure is the misplacement. So then the idea is that what is the best position to put the shunt and get the highest possible success rate for that. And that's why, basically, why mathematics are involved in this problem. Actually, for modeling hydrocephalus, what we need, so is that, first of all, the first question is that what is the biomechanics of the brain, which model we're going to use, what is the parameters over there, and if we could answer to this question, there are also some other applications, like, for example, there are some groups in Australia and collaborators are in Japan, which are working on surgical robot control systems, and they also need to know about the biomechanics of the brain for that system, because they need to predict the deformation. And also, it has also application. It could also have application on the head injury, but of course, it is a short-time behavior in concern with the hydrocephalus, which is a long time. For example, this is. And also, the model not only can be applied for the brain; it can be also applied for very soft tissue like liver and kidney. So let me give you some background about the mathematical things that have been done. We can, in rough speaking, divide the mathematical background in two groups. The first one, which is to consider brain as a viscoelastic material. Actually, it is somehow started by work by Hakim et al., which they assume the brain actually to be a viscoelastic material, and also it's incompressible, and there are too many old and recent works which they have considered brain as a viscoelastic material, linear, quasi-linear, and non-linear, depends on the strain rate, which I will talk about them later. And the other theory is called consolidation, which in this case the brain parenchyma is treated as a porous linearly elastic solid with Newtonian fluid filled pores, and which this model is good to study the interaction between the CSF and the brain tissue, in contrast with the viscoelastic material, which is good to, when we are interested to study the response of the brain tissue to applied loads. And again, there are too many old and recent works on this, but this one, the theory of consolidation, is more new, and our group is also, for example, Dr. Tenti and Dr. Soliman have done some work on this area as well. But now let's go back to the previous slide. Basically, what we can say that if we, for example, we want to get the best position of the, for example, shunt, using, for example, modern imaging processes, what we can do is to, for example, guess that what is the final shape after Shanti? If we, for example, have the initial configuration, and then we know that the velocity, which is velocity of decompression, then we can, for example, have a we can guess what is the final configuration of the CSF. But the point with this, and also I will remind you later that, for example, as I mentioned here, another using this image processing technique use, which one of the best one is the which is which somehow good reasonable results is level set method, which in our group, for example, Jill and also Karina have worked on that, and gives quite reasonable results comparing with the experiments and what we have from the real data. But the only problem is that we must know beforehand the velocity of the compression. So then the question is that what velocity we need to actually use, we have to use, and that's our aim to actually find some way to get the value of this decompression velocity. And that's why we were interested to this biomechanics of the brain to have some idea about this decompression velocity. And then we can use, for example, and apply that for, on this level set method. Actually, before I come to this group, Karina has started to work on this problem. She used, for example, some kind of quasi-linear viscoelastic model and had some estimation for the velocity. But what I did actually is to generalize her model somehow and see that what is the best model and the best parameters that gives the best actually fitting with the experimental data. And that's actually the aim of my talk today. So to start, let's start with very simple and basic idea, which might be a little boring for you, just a reminder. We know that the definition of the stress is, because I'm going to introduce the quasi-linear viscoelasticity, so I'll start with the basic ideas and then we'll go to the quasi-linear viscoelasticity model. So we know that the stress is basically force per unit area, and we can have, for example, different components, like, for example, as you can see in the picture, the normal to x1, normal to x2, and the components normal to x3. So we have a matrix of stresses, and which is symmetric idle weights. And also we can define a strain as the formation of a solid that can be related to the stresses. So if we have, for example, some inaxial extension, as in the picture, so we can define a strain as L minus L0 over L0. So what we can, for example, have is, what the aim is to have a stress-strain relationship, or, for example, a stress and a stress ratio, which is simply L divided by L0. The most simple one model, which is Hookean law, assume that sigma has a really linear relationship with the strain. So if we just consider, let's say, that a compression, a uniaxial compression for infinitesimal strain, then we can say that simply sigma has a linear relationship with the strain. And if we consider, for example, a shear, then tau is related to tangent alpha, which is the strain parameter, through this shear modulus. But this is quite a very simple model, and many times it doesn't work. For most of the material, it doesn't work. So we need to know the constitutive equations. There are basically three different models for the constitutive equation, which works somehow good for many of the materials. The first one is non-viscous fluid, which is a fluid that simply tests the stress tensor is isotropic and is proportional to the pressure, and it is just diagonalized. So sigma ij is simply minus p delta ij, and p is the pressure related to the temperature and density through the, for example, equation of state from the thermodynamics. And we can also have Newtonian viscous fluid, which in this case, the shear stress is linearly proportional to the strain rate. So we have sigma ij equal to minus p delta ij plus d ij kl vkl. And v is the strain rate tensor, and d is a tensor of viscosity coefficients of the fluid. Okay, I don't want to go to the details of this model, just a reminder. And we do have also Hookean elastic solid, which again simply sigma, I mean stress, is proportional to the strain by the coefficient Cij kl. Well, but we know that there are some materials which are not solid or fluid, and those are called viscoelastic material. Basically, they do have a certain rigidity, such that, which is a characteristic of a solid, and at the same time, they flow and dissipate energy. So these kind of material are called viscoelastic material, and the stress response of this material depends on both strain applied and the strain rate. There are three important definitions here: stress relaxation, creep, and hysteresis. So let's consider, for example, a simple experiment. Consider a bar subjected to a force from both ends. Then we can, for example, measure a stress, which is simply force divided by area, cross-section area, and also we can measure a strain, which is simply L minus L0 divided by L. So if we apply the strain, but the strain be maintained constant afterward, then the corresponding stresses induced in the body decrease with time. If you look at the first picture, we have applied the strain up to the point P, but after that point, the strain is constant. So what happens is that it is still changed with time, and we do have the relaxation. But on the other hand, if the body is suddenly stressed, and then stress is maintained constant afterwards, for example, after the point P in the second curve, what happens is that it tries to be stabilized, so after some lying time, it's going to be a constant. So these two are called relaxation and creep. And also we do have hysteresis, which basically says that if the body is subjected to a cyclic loading, then the stress-strain relationship in the loading process is usually somewhat different from that in the unloading process. Well, to define the viscoelastic material, we can use a very basic element like a spring and dashpot. So if you remember, for the linear relationship, I mean sigma is equal to E epsilon, it is quite similar with the spring law, which says simply F is equal to mu U, mu is the spring constant and U is the displacement. So we can, for example, correspond a solid by a spring, and also on the other hand, if you look at the stress for a fluid, which is proportional to a strain rate, sigma is eta d epsilon dt, and this is not E, this is viscosity eta. Again, it can be correspond to the, for example, force when it's proportional to the velocity, simply. So we can introduce these spring and dashpots, and then try to have different combination of them, and to get a model for the viscoelastic material. There are three famous models. The first one is just a parallel combination of this spring and dashpot. So we can simply use the two equations that was in the previous slide to get the differential equation governed between the stress and strain. So force F is here like stress, and U is, which is displacement, is just like strain. So through that equation, we can get the stress-strain relationship or constitutive equation. And we can also have, for example, the parallel combination of this dashpot and spring and get the work model and again calculate the equation governed between the stress and the strain. And more complicated, we can have the Kelvin model. So the point is that, okay, let's see that how they work. As an example, let's consider and try to solve the equation for u of t when ft is a unit step function. So which means that, for example, we have applied a force and it is constant after after war. So we expect, if you remember from those figures, we expect when we, for example, have some constant force after war, then what happens is that we should get this creep function. And we can do the inverse to calculate the relaxation function. So if we do that, we can have for these three different models, the creep functions and the relaxation functions. These models work for some of the material, some of the viscoelastic material, but okay, let's first generalize these models for the Boltzmann superposition, which say that simply if we do have a bar subjected to a force F and elongation U of T, what we can have, this is just generalization of those three models, so all of them are just some special case of the Boltzmann model, so we can have U of T related to dF by dt prime, dt prime, and the proportional constant is related to, is a function of t minus t prime. And also we can have an inverse process to get f of t in terms of u. So clearly these c and k are creep and relaxation functions. And if we, for example, generalize the relaxation function came from the Maxwell models and other models, we can generalize it to be an exponential form, which is somehow a discretized spectrum of the, in terms of the nu n, alpha n in terms of nu n. So let's go further and see that what is the quasi-linear viscoelasticity, because many of the biological systems we cannot apply the linear viscoelasticity theory and we have to go the quasi-linear. Basically, when we have very small amplitude of about equilibrium, the strain rate is quite small, then we can apply the linear viscoelasticity theory. And for a finite deformation, the nonlinear stress strain characteristic of the tissue must be accounted for. However, for the biological materials, we need to consider the quasi-linear relaxation function, which basically say that our strain stress is not only a function of strain, and also, but also it depends on the strain rate. The basic assumption on the quasi-linear viscoelasticity is to consider the relaxation function to be two functions, actually separated function, g of t multiplied by the elastic response of the system, which is te of lambda. So g of t is called reduced relaxation function, and te lambda is the elastic response. So now, using this relaxation function, now we can apply the Boltzmann superposition to get the constitutive equation for the quasi-linear viscoelasticity theory. And it's called somehow with quasi-linear because you can see that this summation over the relaxation function, reduced relaxation function, g of t is just linear, but we have a nonlinear form for te of lambda. So it is somehow a combination of linear and nonlinear theory. And remember that TE is a function of lambda, which lambda is, if you remember, was a stretch ratio, just simply L divided by L0. So to get the derivative, we have to take derivative with respect to lambda and then leave lambda dt prime. And the relaxation function, as we discussed, could be, for example, an exponential form, like mu of t, which is a series of exponential, it is mostly enough to consider just two terms of that. But also, it has been shown by Fong that this discretized version of the relaxation function is not good. Somehow, for example, when you consider the line time behavior, it doesn't match very well with the experiment. So it is better to go and consider the continuous relaxation function. And he obtained this form for the relaxation function. Tau 1, tau 2 are called the relaxation times, and C is a constant, and E1Z is the exponential integral given on this relation. So what we have, we do have the relaxation function. Now the question is how we can calculate the elastic response of the material. One of the actually most well-known methods to calculate TE is based on the strain energy approach. So what is that? Let's remind you that we can have the principal stretch ratios in three dimension, lambda 1, lambda 2, and lambda 3. For example, if you look at the picture, I have given some example for biaxial tension, which means that, for example, in both x and y direction, lambda 1 and lambda 2 are equal, and simply L divided by L0. And on the z direction, it can be related to lambda, because for the compressibility, we always have this relation that lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3 must be equal to 1. So, for example, lambda 3 should be lambda to the power of minus 2 in that biaxial tension. So, and also we can introduce the strain invariance, which also can be related to the stretch ratios lambda 1, lambda 2, and lambda 3. So the basic idea on the strain energy is to give the best form, to actually postulate the best form of the strain energy. And for an isotropic material, it is known that it might be a function of invariance or a function of stretch ratios parameters. And two very well-known forms for the strain energy is the polynomial one and the Ogden model. For the polynomial one, we have I1 minus 3 to the power I and I2 minus 3 to the power J. And remember that I1 and I2 could be related to the principal stretch ratios lambda 1, lambda 2, and lambda 3 through these equations. So if you consider just the linear terms, we can get C10, I1 minus 3, plus C01, I2 minus 3, which is called the famous Mooney-Rivlin strain energy. And in, I guess, in 1976, also Ogden introduced this form of the strain energy, which could be fitted to the experimental results very well. So these are basically two famous strain energy functions. And remember that we do have also this form for the relaxation function, at least these two famous forms. So then the question is that which one of these models works, which one we have to apply for the brain. We, in principle, we have now the constitutive equation for the brain, because we do have TE, and we know that what is G, the relaxation function, so we do have the constitutive equation, the stress-strain relationship, and also from the experiment, we can have a plot for sigma in terms of strain or, for example, lambda. So then the question is that which of these models is better to use? And before I start this work, actually, Corina and then Katrin, they actually considered this model. They applied Mooney-Rivlin strain energy, and also with the Phong relaxation function, which is known to be a better relaxation function, and get, for example, the parameters, and also they applied for the hydrocephalus. But before that, we need to answer this question that which one of these models are better to consider as a model for the biomechanics of the brain. So let me give you some examples. Let's consider some uniaxial compression. In this case, lambda 1 is equal to lambda, and lambda 2 and lambda 3 are equal because we just have compression in one axis, one direction, and because of the incompressibility, clearly lambda 2 and lambda 3 might be equal to lambda to the power minus 1/2. So then the non-zero component of the strength can be obtained through this equation. So for Mooney-Rivlin and Ogden model, I have given the expressions for T of E in terms of the lambda. So for this experiment, for this kind of, for example, experiment, uniaxial compression, we have TE. Of course, we can calculate it easily for shear or, for example, extension, which is the same for sure for extension. So we do have the relaxation function. So in principle, if we have some experiment like this, we have some cylinder, for example, from the brain, let's say, and we compress it, then what happens is that the stretch ratio lambda, L over L, can be simply 1 plus V over LT, which V is the displacement velocity, or simply related to the strain rate. So using that equation, that integral equation, we can write down the constitutive equation, for example, for the Ogden model and Fong's relaxation function. So what we have done is that, for example, to apply these different models, let's say Fong's relaxation function, exponential model, Ogden model, and Mooney-Rivlin, consider all these models, try to compare with the experiment and see that which one is the best. But before going to that, I would like to, okay, this is some experiments which we used. This is experiment by Still and McHenry. Okay, in 70, these are somehow old data. The data are given for different rates. For the first one, these are not, the velocity are inch per second. So 0.02, 0.2, and 10. Different rates?
Is that in vivo or in vitro?
Pardon?
In vivo or in vitro?
In vitro.
Yeah, sure. Okay, and the data, one of them is for the human and the other one is for the monkey. And so, okay, we have a stress in terms of, and the x-axis I believe to be log of lambda, and lambda is the stress ratio. So we do have the data, let's say in terms of lambda or in terms of time, because lambda is related to time by V plus 1 plus VL over T. 1 plus VT over L. So we do have experimental data, so we can try to fit those equations with the experimental data. But before going there, I would like to bring your attention to another experiment, which is recently is done. And the aim of the Prange et al. In 2000, and a journal which is called a Stop Car Crash Journal. And this is basically done for the head injury, for example, which is, but the aim of the work has been to, for example, distinguish what is the difference between the different regions of the brain, like what is the difference between gray matter and white matter, because we know that there are two kinds of the matter in the brain, and also what is the effect of directions, like if they have, in the right side, you can see that they have two different directions from the brain, and they want to actually study the mechanical properties with respect to the regions, different directions, and different samples, because one of them is from the human, the other one was from porcine. So what they did, the interesting thing was here. They applied the Ogden model. Of course, the experiment was shear. It is simple to calculate shear stress in terms of lambda from the Ogden model for the incompressible, for example, material. So what they did is that they simply changed mu by mu of t and say that, okay, if we want to consider the time dependence of the material here, then we can simply change mu by mu of t without that convolution integral. So we thought that maybe sometimes this is correct to do. And also, so what I did also try to use Ogden again and Mooney-Rivlin strain energy with again different kind of relaxation function and just try to apply with this simple model to see that what we get comparing with the experiments. So, and yeah, this is the result of their experiments. Let me just, because I have introduced their experiment, let me just very briefly tell what is the experiment. What they have calculated is normal stress in terms of ratio for different samples. This is one of their, for example, graphs. And at the end, they try to fit the experimental data with that function mu of t and comparing results together. For example, the figure 4 in their paper is the difference between human and porcine for the gray matter, which seems to be quite close together. So if we, for example, have much more data for the idea is that if we have much more data for animals, then we can maybe try to use them, for example, the parameters for the human brain as well. And the second one, I guess, is, yeah, for different, one sample from the gray matter and two different samples from different parts of the white matter, and they have, again, different results for the relaxation function. And the other one is the directional dependence, which if we, for example, be in the gray, let's say that we have two different samples from the gray matter, and in D1 and D2 directions. So we can see that, for example, the last one is quite interesting result, because the results are quite close to each other, and means that if we, for example, apply the isotropic, for example, assumption for the brain, for the gray matter, it works quite well. I think I don't have the figure for the white matter, but it shows that, for example, it is much more anisotropy. So clearly, there are different regions have different of the brain have different, for example, isotropy. The gray matter is much more isotropy than the white matter. So let's go back to the work that we have done. First of all, you can see that, for example, we have Phong relaxation function, exponential one, Mooney-Rivlin strain energy, and also the Eigen model. So there can be quite different combinations of them, which we did all of them. And so I don't want to show all the results, so it's just some part of them. So if we just use that simple approach, I mean, if we don't consider that convolution integral and just simply change mu by mu of t, let's see what happens. Clearly, for two first rows of the data, you can see that what I got for the parameters are negative, which means that physically are incorrect. So that means that for low strain rates, we cannot use this approach. But for the v equal to 2 and v equal to 10, which somehow are high values for the strain rate, then you can see that the model works quite well with the experiments. So one can simply say that when we have high values of the strain, which somehow we expect, that means that very short time, then we don't need to do that convolution integral over them, and this approximation will give us some idea about the parameters, and you can see that it quite works well with the experiments. I forgot to tell that the x-axis is time, and the y-axis is the stress. So we could also consider, for example, in this simple case, applying an Eigen model, again, we had the similar results for the low values of rates to first row. I couldn't get, for example, some reasonable parameter, but for the second, for the third and fourth one, we have, again, good agreement with the experimental data. And because, as I mentioned, this paper is written for the head injury, which is quite a short time behavior, so that's why they have considered such a simple model, and it simply works. So now let's go to the integral approach and consider that complicated integral, try to fit the parameters with the experiments, and this is the result. Clearly, if we use the Mooney-Rivlin strain energy, for lower strains, again, you can see that there is no good compatible with the experiment, so that means even I couldn't get any parameters for 0.02, the fitting was quite bad, but it works well for, again, high strain values. So, but if we do that for the Eigen model and Phong relaxation function, you can see that for all strain rates, we can get a very good agreement between the theory and experiments. So I tried all of these different combinations, as I applied for the exponential one, but as I mentioned, the exponential relaxation function seems to not work very well, and so it might be better to just use this Phong relaxation function, and clearly the Eigen model works quite well, and so the summary of this result is that the simple approach can be used for high rates of strain, which is for the short time means. The Mooney and Rivlin strain energy is not good for very low strain rates. What we can do, we can, for example, if you remember in the main formula, I just considered the linear terms for the strain energy. What we can do to consider, for example, higher order terms, but there is two negative points with that. The first one is that then we have too much parameters there. We have, for example, C11, C12, C21. There are many complicated parameters there. And also, it has been shown that, for example, It works well if we consider, for example, higher order terms for the compression, but with the either experiment and basically for extension, that model doesn't give a reasonable comparative result with the experiments. But the Eigen model works very well for all strain rates, and also it just have two parameters, so it is quite simple to fit the data with this model. And as I mentioned, so the for the relaxation function, it seems to be the fund relaxation function, which has been shown that it worked quite well for long-time behavior. It gives good results. So the bottom line is simply that this Eigen model and fund relaxation function is the best model to apply for the biomechanics of the brain, and we do have the parameters. So the next step would be to calculate the compression velocity, as I mentioned in my in the first part of my talk, to apply it for the hydrocephalus and see that what we get comparing with, the, for example, the result that Kurnow and Katrin found from, for example, that Mooney and Rivlin tensor, and see that how different are the results. So, and thank you for your attention.